prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors. With Lance. And Erica.
Leave all your sanity behind. It can't help you now.
Welcome to another episode of Unsung Horrors, the podcast where we discuss underseen horror films, specifically those with fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. I'm Lance.
And I'm Erica.
And before we dive into the episode, let's let everybody know how we created and started up a Discord channel.
We did. We have that. I don't know how. I hit some buttons and made some channels and invited some folks, and now we've got an open invite for anyone who's a listener.
Yeah, you go to the link tree and you could just click on the top button to join the Discord channel. It's been a lot of fun. I guess we've had it running for a little over a week, almost 2 weeks, about
a few weeks. Yeah, we started, let's just get a few people in there so we can, you know, people that I knew were already on Discord and could kind of help us get it built out. Shout out to Ryan and Ryan Verrill and Ryan BMD, who both helped me out a little bit with it because I was not doing it right. But Nice. We're all set up now. We've got a Junesploitation channel in there, which is already bumping with activity.
Yes, because June is just days away, yes. Or weeks away, I guess I should say, or days away when this
it's
drops.
It's like a week away as of when this is going to come out. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's been a lot of fun. A lot of people sharing their picks, already creating lists on Letterboxd and sharing those. Junesploitation's, if you've listened to our past episodes, check them out. We love it. It's a good reason to watch at least 30 movies in a month.
And, you know, even if you can't watch that many, if you can't participate every single day, every now and then, if you need inspiration, you can just see, like, what's the category for today? Okay, it's Fred Williamson.
Exactly. Hell yeah, Fred Williamson.
I can't believe there's... he's done so many movies. And I was like, oh, does Lance even have any that he still hasn't seen yet? And then I was like, wait, he's got, like, over 100 film credits.
So. I'll watch them all one day.
Yeah.
But I feel like I willed that one. I've been on a roll with some of my picks, movie picks, episode picks being released.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about the Blu-ray wish list. This is a win for a Blu-ray wish list for me.
Is it?
Fred Williamson.
Nice.
You know, having it his own day. More people will be watching hopefully his stupider movies, but we'll see.
We'll find out.
But yeah, definitely check out the Discord channel if you guys are on Discord. Okay, so this episode, we're going to be chatting about The Ghost of Sierra de Cobre, written and directed by Joe Stefano. There's different release years listed on the internets out there because it was never actually officially released anywhere, which we'll talk about in just a bit. But the common years listed are 1964, which is about when it finished filming, and 1967, which is when it was first reported to air on television. So as of this recording, it has 554 views on Letterboxd. It's streaming on YouTube, both the 80-minute film version called The Ghost of Sierra de Cobre and the TV pilot 53-minute version known as The Haunted. We'll be covering the production history of the film, the different versions out there. Kino also has a Blu-ray and DVD that they released in 2018, which includes both versions. So, The Ghost of Sierra de Cobre takes place at the Mandor estate. It's about a rich blind man named Henry Mandor who begins receiving phone calls from his dead mother who passed away about a year ago. And she was a woman that was so worried about being buried alive that she insisted that a telephone be installed in her tomb. Henry's wife, Vivia, returns from a business trip and he tells her all about the phone calls he's been receiving. So she hires paranormal investigator / architect Nelson Orion to look into this.
Great name.
Really good name. Also, while she was away, all of Henry's servants were let go, and a new housekeeper stepped into caring for Henry and the Mandor estate, and it's Mrs. Danvers herself, Judith Anderson. Yeah. She's playing this creepy woman named Paulina. And as the film moves along, we find that there's a history between the paranormal investigator Orion and this housekeeper, Paulina. Years ago, Orion worked on a case in a South American village called Sierra de Cobre. where an American teacher was murdered, and some believed it was a supernatural spirit that killed the teacher. Paulina was a resident of Sierra de Cobre during that time, and she claims that Orion botched the case when he determined it wasn't supernatural at all and that the teacher was simply murdered by someone at the village. Also, a hallucinogenic drug was involved in that murder, ayahuasca, but...
Never tried it.
I haven't either.
I'm willing, though.
I read a lot about it in, like, William Burroughs books and stories, mm-hmm. like, growing up.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm on the lookout. But yeah, but before all of that's revealed, Orion works on this case of the mysterious phone calls that Henry Mandor's receiving from his dead mom. As I mentioned, there's two different versions of this, which have two different endings, which we'll be talking about. Mm-hmm. There will be a lot of spoilers, of course. Okay, so I want to hit on a little bit of the production because it is fascinating. There's two different versions out there. The Ghost of Sierra de Cobre was initially filmed as a TV pilot for a new series that CBS wanted called The Haunted. And ABC had The Outer Limits, a lot of success. CBS wanted to, you know, kind of pull in some new viewers. And this series, it was going to follow Nelson Orion, played by Martin Landau, as he investigated a bunch of supernatural happenings. And The Outer Limits was groundbreaking sci-fi TV, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of, you know, it influenced a ton of shows, filmmakers. And arguably the best episodes at the time were written by Joe Stefano. So CBS reached out to Stefano to create a new series for them. And after wrapping up the first season of The Outer Limits in 1963, he began working on and developed this series, The Haunted. He wanted the series to strictly be supernatural horror, no science fiction elements, to separate it a little bit from The Outer Limits. And Ghost of Sierra de Cobre was filmed as the TV pilot. And it took on a lot of different revisions. From what I learned, the pilot episode was going to be called The Black Telephone. Like this, and The Haunted was the name of the actual series. So the episode was going to be The Black Telephone, and The Haunted was a series that CBS had. It was all set. Stefano had written 5 episodes, and this pilot actually made it to the CBS broadcast schedule for 1965 and 66. A fall premiere was set. It was to air Tuesday nights at 10 p.m. Marketing artwork was completed. It was pretty much a done deal. But before it aired, new network execs came in and flushed all of the shows from the previous fired group, except the Wild Wild West, which premiered the fall of 1965. So the show was completely just axed. And it never really had a release after that. Apparently, the first time it aired on television as The Ghost of Sierra de Cobre was in Japan in 1967. And it supposedly aired in Great Britain, Canada, and Australia during the 70s. Never aired in America, apparently. And it stopped airing on television around the globe before VCRs made it into households. So there was never an opportunity for a viewer to record it. So it really is kind of like a, you know, quote, lost film. The first time it actually premiered in a theater was in 2011, after a print of The Haunted was found at UCLA. It was programmed as part of the UCLA's Archive Treasures series, and it was shown with an Outer Limits episode that Joe Stefano had had written called The Unknown. Unfortunately, Stefano died in 2006, so he never actually got to see the premiere. His wife and son attended, which was nice. But
maybe his ghost was there.
Oh, moaning and
I'm kidding. Haunting. I don't believe in ghosts.
Okay, well, we're going to be back
on that bullshit now.
Oh, yeah. We're going to spend 20 minutes on that. But from, you know, interviews and what I read, Stefano firmly believed that the prints were truly lost. Like, he had no idea when he passed that there were prints of The Haunted and The Ghost of Sierra de Cobre out there. And he, in interviews, had said that this was like the best thing he ever did. Like, he felt...
This man wrote Psycho.
He did write Psycho. He had, I guess there's a couple of... he didn't want to... I mean, he thinks... I did read something about saying Psycho kind of held him back from writing and completing films, being involved with films that he really wanted to make. I don't know. Again, yeah, Psycho's... It's amazing. So let's take a look at Stefano's other work. Okay, so obviously he's famous for writing the screenplay of Psycho for Alfred Hitchcock in 1960.
He's also credited for the Psycho remake, but we don't talk about that movie.
The Gus Van.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I can't stand that movie.
I can't either.
And a lot of people have love for it, and that's cool. It's shot by shot, but you know,
it is. I watched it, and I was so mad at it. And I was like, I don't know how you can just like copy what someone else did and make it so goddamn awful. It was a Terror Tuesday recently. And I was like,
oh, I saw that. Yeah.
It was on 35. And I was like, even if it's 35, you're not going to get me to go see that movie. I absolutely refuse.
Vince Vaughn being Vince Vaughn as Norman Bates. Ugh, is just
that's so wrong. No.
So, hey, you want to check in, huh? Yeah, I'm going to motorboat you, huh? You're motorboating. It's just too much. You know, he's like, ugh. Yeah. But the Alfred Hitchcock Psycho rules.
Yeah.
Stefano wrote an amazing screenplay from the Robert Bloch novel.
Yeah.
But his career trajectory is really interesting because he didn't start really writing for television and film until 1956, which was very shortly before Psycho. He was a singer and songwriter for a long time.
Really?
Yes. He started singing and dancing at the age of 6. And as he got older, he was really interested in becoming a performer and actor. And he ended up moving to New York in the 1940s, in his early 20s. And he became a nightclub singer using the name Jerry Stevens. He wrote an off-Broadway production, apparently wrote hundreds of original songs, pop songs, show tunes, instrumentals, just tons of music, and they were recorded by really well-known artists at the time and became hits all over the world.
Damn.
A song called Heartbeat, sung by Ruby Murray.
Heartbeat? Like Heart Beeps, your favorite movie?
No. But double feature, Psycho remake, Heartbeats.
For the worst time ever.
Oh my God. If you want to like kill somebody later that night. he wrote a song called One Dream Tells Me, sung by Karen Chandler. I don't know if any of our listeners are old enough or know this, you know, these songs, but I'll probably pick one of these songs for the end of this episode. Ooh, okay. Sammy Davis Jr. even recorded one of his songs that he wrote called Give a Fool a Chance in 1955. So he was an established songwriter in the 40s, you know, in his 20s. He was had a career. I mean, he was doing really well in New York. And then he met film and TV producer, Leslie Stevens, and they became really close friends. And Stevens kind of persuaded Stefano to start writing, like, hey, you know, you write your own songs. Why don't you get into this and we can start working together? And he did. And Stefano kind of, you know, his stories got really in demand fairly quickly because Stevens kind of helped him, you know, mingle with the crowd. And by 1959, Stefano really wanted to write a screenplay feature with a powerhouse director, which I'm sure was everybody's dream at that point. And he apparently gave a list of 10 directors to his agent to see if they would call him. And a few did. Otto Preminger was the first to call, and he wanted Stefano to adapt The Quiet American. William Wyler also called, but there were creative conflicts there. And then Alfred Hitchcock called, who apparently he was running into trouble on the first draft of Psycho. And he interviewed Stefano, really liked him. But Stefano's quoted as saying he almost turned it down because he did not like the Robert Bloch novel very much at all. But he had a lot of like wild ideas that kind of changed it around. And he ran it by Hitchcock, and Hitchcock was like all in. He loved it. And then, you know, the rest is history. That's what made Stefano in demand as a writer. Apparently, Hitchcock also wanted him to write Marnie in 1964. But Stefano, at this point, he declined because he was already committed to writing episodes for The Outer Limits. And The Outer Limits was created by the friend that got him into writing, his producer friend, Leslie Stevens. He was also a director. Stefano wrote a total of 12 episodes for The Outer Limits. And then he went on to create his own failed series, The Haunted, which is what we're talking about. And this film, The Ghost of Sierra de Cobre, is his only directing credit. Never directed before or after. He wasn't going to direct. It was a guy named Robert Stevens who directed a bunch of Twilight Zone episodes, Alfred Hitchcock Presents episodes. He was all set to start directing this. But he last minute, due to health issues, he had to drop out. So Stefano took the helm. But he did. He continued writing a few films and mostly TV movies and TV series. He wrote a TV movie called Snow Beast in 1977, which we both watched. Yeah. I saw. This would work as a Junesploitation ripoff because it's a total Jaws ripoff.
100%. Yeah.
You know, but, you know, instead of like, you know, Summer Vacation or whatever, it's a Winter Carnival.
Right. I mean, it would work for a Junesploitation pick for ripoff, but it's not very good.
No, it's not. Bo Svenson plays an Olympic skiing medalist named Gar.
Gar.
You know, he's like this has-been, and he goes to the skiing resort to look for a job.
Yeah.
And he ends up getting the job for about 20 minutes.
And then he has to go hunt the snow beast.
Yes.
But you really don't see it. You see the arm, mostly.
Yeah. And you then see the face.
At the end.
Real quick.
A few times.
And it looks cool.
It looks fucking great. I'm like, why are you not showing this more?
Exactly.
I mean, maybe it looks great because they only show flashes of it, but still.
Yeah. Yeah, again, though, it's very Jaws, like, you know, the ranger kills a bear and he's like, we got it.
Yeah.
And they're like, cut it open.
It's just so, yeah, it's like beat for beat fucking Jaws. So,
yeah.
And yeah, like, you don't have a new sheriff, you've got a new ski school director kind of thing. I mean, it's cute. Maybe I should reevaluate what I think I gave it 2 stars. Maybe I should give it 4.
Yeah, I gave it like 2.5. I'd watch it again, but it isn't very good.
No. Yeah.
There's a lot better Jaws ripoffs out there.
For sure. There's a lot better TV movies that he's written as well. I talked about a couple of them in our episode with Amanda Reyes, a couple of Shelley Winters movies, one called Revenge and another called The Death of Innocence. And those are both really good. I'd recommend those.
Nice. And you watched a few of his other films.
I did.
Written by Stefano, The Naked Edge and what was it? Eye of the Cat?
Yeah. So Naked Edge, 1961, was starring Gary Cooper and Peter Cushing, isn't it?
Yeah, I saw that.
Gary Cooper is pretty flat in it. I usually really like him, but it starts with a trial and Cooper is testifying against someone and that person ends up getting convicted. And then 5 years later, it comes out that, oh, maybe it was actually Cooper that killed her and or killed this guy because there's a lot of coincidences that make it like he looks 100% guilty and his wife is like not convinced that he's innocent. And so it's this... Mm. We're kind of following along with her and it was good in the sense of, I mean, you're like, is he innocent or is he guilty? And you really don't know because he clearly looks very guilty. Like everything is pointing at him to be guilty. So I'm not going to spoil it in case anyone wants to watch, but Peter Cushing 100% steals it. And he's only in like 2 scenes as the prosecuting lawyer. And I'm fully convinced that if he never worked out as an actor, he would have been the best fucking lawyer ever.
Right.
Because, like, I mean, if Peter Cushing is interrogating me, I would be like, yes, sir. I know. Yes, I did. Okay, fine. I did it.
Yeah. I mean, perfect actor. Like, but that sounds cool. I mean, it sounds like Stefano builds up the suspense and thrills.
It was good.
What about that other one?
Oh, yeah. So Naked Edge was on YouTube. So was Eye of the Cat. And this was a pretty fun, maybe predictable caper. It's about a woman, she's a hairdresser, and she finds out one of her clients is like pretty much loaded, but she is leaving her fortune to her cats. So
respect.
She finds the nephew of this woman who like they're on the outs, and she goes to the nephew and she's like, hey, you got to get back in with your aunt and convince and because once you do that, she'll will everything to you
right.
instead of the cats. And so they have this whole like scheme to like do all this. There are a million fucking cats in this movie. I love it. It would be a perfect double with Night of a Thousand Cats starring Hugo Stiglitz.
Yeah.
Like there's that many cats in this. There's cats flying everywhere. There's cats just like chomping down on raw meat everywhere. Oh my God.
Love it.
Yeah. So it, as a movie, like plot wise, it's fine. It's pretty predictable. Like you kind of see like where it's headed. Like once the few characters that are in it are introduced, but it's worth it for all the cats in the movie. It just is.
Nice. Yeah, so I mentioned that Stefano wrote some TV series. He wrote an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, and he developed and wrote some episodes of the original Swamp Thing series from 1990.
Hmm.
I didn't realize he was an actual producer for it. I have seen some of those episodes. I love Swamp Thing. I do want to visit them. I know that at one time they were streaming somewhere, so I do want to see if I can find those. Okay, enough on Stefano. Do you have anything else you want to talk about?
No, only that, and I guess this could kind of transition into someone else from the crew, but he did, you know, like you said, he only directed this one thing, and I don't want to really give him too much credit for how this movie looks and is, because this is 100% looks great and moves the way that it does, I think, because of the cinematography.
100%, yeah. I think that's the main reason why I picked this.
Okay.
Is because of the way it looks. It's shot by cinematographer Conrad Hall, who's a pro.
Yeah.
He's won multiple Oscars for Butch Cassidy, The Sundance Kid, American Beauty, Road to Perdition. Other films he shot, The Marathon Man, Cool Hand Luke, Harper, and one of the best, Fat City.
Stacey Keach.
And Susan Tyrell. Yeah.
Good Lord. That's like, that's Keach's best performance. You know what? That's both of their best performance, I think.
Yeah. I mean, they're so real in it. Like, it looks, I love that movie so much. Yeah. I watched it for the first time like last year, mm-hmm. and it fucking blew me away.
Yeah. I think I watched it just a couple of years ago. It was actually for the old podcast, and I had film critic Daniel Barnes as a guest for that one. And he, he loved that movie. And it was great talking with him about it, because I was just like, it's one of those movies where you watch it and you're like, this is great. And then you talk to someone who like loves that movie and you're like, I love this movie so much more. But yeah, Fat City, he also shot Day of the Locust, which is great. It's got Donald Sutherland, you know, curb stomping a kid in it. Coincidentally, I had this old Twilight Time Blu-ray on my shelf for a while, and I finally got around to watching it like a month ago with John Morituri, starring Marlon Brando. That one was really good. And then he also shot Hell in the Pacific, which I love. It's got Lee Marvin and Toshirô Mifune on an island, stuck on an island together. And it's like post-war movie. So like, you know, one American, one Japanese, and they're both like, they can't communicate with one another because neither speaks the other's language. And right. So they're just like stranded on a desert island, like trying to figure out how to live together. And there's this one moment in it where, you know, cause you're on an island, you don't have any possessions. And like Lee Marvin like flips out because Mifune's character took this log, and Lee Marvin goes over there and he's like, that's my log. And I was like, wow, that's like college roommate vibes right there.
Well, yeah, it's like, that sounds like an American reaction vibe for like through and through.
Yeah, 100%. But yeah, I love that movie. He also did a movie that I haven't seen, but I wanted to bring it up because Catch My Soul, 1974. It's a rock and roll adaptation of Othello, which is my fourth favorite Shakespeare play. I know that's a very specific number, but I have very specific numbers for my Shakespeare love. Number one is Titus Andronicus, for anyone who was curious. And if you know me, you know why. This one has an out-of-print Blu-ray from Etiquette Pictures, which is an old sub-label of Vinegar Syndrome. So if anyone has this and doesn't want it and, you know, is willing to sell it for a non-inflated price, hit me up, because I would love to own this.
Yeah, Susan Tyrell's in there.
Yes.
She's in the cast.
Yes. She's not Desdemona, but she's in it.
Awesome. Yeah, I watched one of his movies that he shot called Incubus from 1966.
That movie fucking rules. Yeah, it's the William Shatner Esperanto one.
Yes, yeah. It's all shot in Esperanto, so it's funny to see these American and English actors try and speak and enunciate this language, which I guess at that time, I think I read it was the second movie ever to be shot.
Second? Oh, I thought it was the first.
Maybe it was the first. Okay. Or maybe I read there was only two, Phil. I don't know.
Okay.
But yeah, that was directed by Leslie Stevens, who, you know, created The Outer Limits. It stars William Shatner, who this is like his role right before he's Kirk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he becomes a huge star. It's shot really well. Obviously, Conrad Hall. To me, it's like Stevens is seemingly trying hard to be like Bergman or something. Like just the way everything's shadowed and framed.
Yeah.
About these succubi luring these terrible people to hell to give up their souls to the Prince of Darkness. But one of them wants to try to persuade and lure a good person, that good person being William Shatner, to show her power to the devil in order to become a full-on demon. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. But again, yeah, Conrad Hall, it makes a lot of these movies worth watching.
Yeah, I think, you know, and we don't usually talk about like assistant directors or assistant cinematographers or anything like that, but I think it is worth noting that William Fraker did additional photography on this. You know, he's got Rosemary's Baby, Bullet. Exorcist 2, Paint Your Wagon, Incubus 1966 on there too.
War Games, Tombstone.
All those. He also did a movie called The Killer Inside Me, 1976, starring Stacey Keach and Susan Tyrell. I don't recommend it. I'm sorry. Huh. I gave it 2 stars. It's on paper, it looks great, but it's not. Just watch Fat City instead.
Right. Yeah, no, yeah, yeah. William Fraker, like you said, a lot of the crew from The Ghost of Sierra Cobra came from The Outer Limits. So Conrad Hall was a crew member for the television series William Fraker. who else? The editor, Tony DeMarco, mm-hmm. assistant director, Greg Peters, even the makeup, full sound crew. They all came over from Outer Limits. So Stefano obviously had a crew that he knew really well and was real familiar with. And I mean, you could see it on screen. Everything's just clicking. Also the composer, he's from the Outer Limits, Dominic Frontieri. And while he did compose a new original score for The Ghost of Sierra de Cobre, Stefano did not like it. He's like, what is this? Like, you're really good. This sounds like everything else that's out there. Mm. So other than that opening moaning theme, you know, and then, you know, the music starts, the score used in throughout the whole episode or the movie was imported from a score Frontieri had already completed and did on The Outer Limits. From an episode called The Forms of Things Unknown. It's an episode that Stefano wrote, so obviously I guess he loved the music. And it's a good score. I mean, the moaning themes, I like the opening the best because it's a hook.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when, you know, you're trying to find music for, like, your podcast. You want something that kind of matches your episodes or something or what your theme is.
Yeah.
It would have been good, like, to hear that weekly on TV. It did seem a little intentional, though, that it was trying to sound like Bernstein's Psycho. A little bit,
yeah.
But I guess everybody was kind of trying to, you know, emulate that work because it's great horror music.
Yeah, there was a sound effect in there that, and this is why, like, I love Hate John sometimes, because we're watching this and there's like this certain sound when something supernatural is about to happen, mm-hmm. and he was like, "That's the sound from Evil Dead 2," and he like. Describe the scene, and I haven't watched Evil Dead 2 in a few years, so I my brain doesn't work like John, so I have no idea what he's talking about. I will put those two sounds in side by side because I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, no, I'd love to hear that. Because, I know what sound you're talking about. There's like a couple of sounds. There's a lot of the wind sound. There's the moaning. And then there's this weird kind of like a buzzing or something. Or is it like a...
It's hard to describe.
I think that, I mean, that could be pulled from Outer Limits episodes too. Like who knows where they got sounds from.
Yeah.
Because it's the same crew.
I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, Sam Raimi, like some inspiration from that. If John was like very distinctly like, that's from Evil Dead 2, then I mean, trust him. He's always right. I hate saying that.
It's the sound like when you see a ghost, like all the ghosts I've seen, you hear mm-hmm. that, you hear that sound. It's very accurate.
He did a few other movies that I've seen, Frontieri, that is, mm-hmm. The scores for. So Freebie and the Bean, which I don't know if you went to this, but Alamo did a screening a few years ago with stuntman Gary Kent doing a Q&A afterwards, which was really fun.
No, I didn't go to that.
Freebie and the Bean's a lot of fun. Cars going through apartments and stuff like that. It's a lot of fun.
Nice.
Color of Night, starring Bruce Willis. That was the first time I got to see Bruce Willis's Willie. and then speaking of penises, I also saw Robert Culp's in a movie called A Name for Evil.
Yeah. That was a movie actually I had on my list as potential episodes because it seemed interesting.
I
didn't know there was... Penile.
Yeah, I think it's on the spreadsheet even.
It might be, yeah.
And it was produced by Penthouse and it's clear like what scenes were added in from them in there. But otherwise it's pretty, I wrote in my review that it would make, that you could actually double feature this with Natural Enemies because even though it's technically a story about a couple moving into a house to restore it and like there's a ghost there that's like, this is my house. It's more about their relationship and it kind of disintegrating than anything. And then there's just weird sex orgies and Robert Culp's penis. So I don't know that it would... It's an interesting movie. I will give it that. Like I'd recommend watching it just because of the... weirdness of it, but I don't think it would make a good episode.
Okay. That's good. I'll cross off the list. Frontieri also did, you know, you already mentioned the stuntman. He did compose that and Hang 'Em High from 1968. So he has some good credits.
Yeah. He did, some TV movies as well. My favorite, Don't Go to Sleep. Revenge, which I mentioned, the Shelley Winters one. And then another one that I mentioned, the Amanda episode, The Immortal, starring Christopher George.
Nice. Okay, so the Haunted series was going to follow a single character, and that's Nelson O'Ryan, badass name, played by the great Martin Landau. He's a bit like a David Sorrell in Fear No Evil type character, where he has like a day job, architect, restores old homes. But he's fascinated and works with paranormal, you know, happenings. This is actually Landau's first lead role. So all his previous TV roles, again, he did some Outer Limits episodes where he met Stefano. His films, they were all supporting. His biggest role being that of Leonard in Hitchcock's North by Northwest from 1959.
Yeah.
And he apparently was obviously very excited about playing a lead recurring role in The Haunted. He was very excited about this series. And then when he learned that the new CBS execs weren't moving forward, he asked and really contacted Joe Stefano to like push back. He's like, dude, you have, I don't think he said dude, but he's like, dude, you have like the credentials, you have the power. But at that point, Stefano, from what I learned, was completely over it. He was tired. He was done with all this network, you know, mumbo jumbo.
Yeah.
The Outer Limits on ABC was gutted and he was getting the same treatment here on The Haunted. So he just kind of threw his hands up and walked away. Martin Landau, he was offered the role of Spock. I think a lot of people know this for Star Trek, the series. He turned it down because he said the character had no emotion and it was the complete opposite of what he wanted to do as an actor. He had a big role in the TV series Mission Impossible. And when he left that series, Leonard Nimoy took over his role. I had read that he said that him and Leonard Nimoy kind of share a lot of the same physiques and, you know, they could be like cast in a lot of the same roles, he said.
Yeah.
But he's in so many great films. He won an Academy Award in 1996 for Best Supporting Actor as Bela Lugosi in Tim Burton's Ed Wood.
Fantastic performance.
Yes, I think one of Tim Burton's best movies. He was also in Burton's Sleepy Hollow, and he provided a voice in Frankenweenie, which I've never seen.
He was in the Anna Nicole Smith story. He played her old crusty husband.
Jeez.
He's all over the place.
It was between him and Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah. I watched a couple, you know, new to me Martin Landau movies.
Saw one with the great Jim Brown.
R.I.P. Jim Brown.
Recently,
yeah.
Just yesterday.
I hope I didn't do that because I watched it like a few days ago before he passed. Yeah. And Black Gun was great. And he's in it as like the bad guy in it. And Jim Brown being Jim Brown doing his thing and loving the ladies and...
Hell yeah.
Man.
RIP to a great actor, ball player, civil rights activist.
100%. Yeah. Another one I watched from him was, I was kind of hoping it'd be a bit more like nomsploitation, but it's called Welcome Home, Johnny Bristol. And it's about a POW who, you know, he comes home, name of the title, name of the movie. And he's like, yeah, I just want to go back to my hometown, which is this place called Charles, Vermont. And he tries to go there and the town is gone. And he's like, what the fuck? He's like, I have all these memories of it. And
it's like a ghost town. Nobody's living there. It's empty buildings.
It's nothing. No buildings. It doesn't exist. Wow. The town itself is not there. You know, then you have to decide, okay, is he crazy? And did he make up this whole thing in order to cope with the trauma of being a prisoner of war? Or is there some huge conspiracy where they like wiped out the town because of something happening and like everyone's in on it? And I'm not going to spoil it because for anybody that wants to watch it.
It's good.
It's okay.
Sounds cool.
I don't want to like build it up too much, but it did like at a certain point, I was like, I decided which one I thought it was and I was right. And I was... So I do want to like, it could be predictable for some folks, but I think it was a really good performance from him. I mean, he always delivers though.
He does. And I completely forgot, you know, I watched a few of his films too for this episode, but everything I'd seen him in before, I'm like, this guy's a great actor, but watching him and really concentrating on his performance, I'm like, this guy's one of the best. Mm-hmm. I mean, best American actors. I watched, I watched a lot of obscure shit, you know, stuff that, you know, not a lot of his like Hollywood, more bigger production.
Sure.
A TV movie called The Fall of the House of Usher from 1979.
Okay.
This was directed by James Conway, who directed The Boogans. But this is a really great adaptation. It sticks true to the prose story. Landau plays Roderick Usher.
Okay.
And Robert Hayes, who's Ted Stryker from Airplane.
Oh, okay.
He's the lead. He plays Jonathan Creswell, the friend of Roderick, who's there to try and fix the house.
Right.
But Landau's just acting circles around everybody, just paranoid. And I recommend it. I think that was on Tubi or YouTube.
Okay.
Then I watched Savage from 1973. This is directed by Steven Spielberg.
I was going to watch this and I saw you did. And I was like.
Well, the ratings on it on Letterboxd are super low.
I saw that too.
And what I found, I loved it first off. I thought it was really captivating. It's a great little thriller. You kind of don't know how it's going to end up to the last minute.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, like what the mystery is, but you don't know how it kind of all comes together. But this was actually another failed TV pilot for a series called The Savage Report. And this episode was originally titled Watchdog, but it was supposed to star Martin Landau as Paul Savage. You know, it was going to be a weekly thing where basically he's like a news reporter and he was just going to solve all these crazy cases. And again, he was so excited about this and it fell through. So he has some bad luck with starring in his own series. But yeah, it's like 73 minutes, no wasted space of dialogue that I found. I loved it.
Yeah. Do you think the ratings are people like having certain Spielbergian expectations or something?
That's what I had put in my Letterboxd review is like, if you compare it to Steven Spielberg's feature films, I get it. You know, it's not Raiders of the Lost. You know, you're not going to get that from a young Spielberg doing TV movies.
Right.
And apparently he was very upset being forced to do this. I read a little bit about the movie after I watched it. And he wanted, after his duel, he had only done duel, and he wanted to just do feature films. So when he was contractually obligated to do one more TV movie for the network, mm-hmm. for Universal, apparently he like threw a fit. Tipper tantrum.
You're a big baby.
I get it, though. I mean, he had a vision. Obviously, it was a correct vision and he saw it. But
sure.
I wouldn't insult this last TV movie he did because I thought it was great.
Yeah. Okay.
Then I watched the last movie I watched. This was Without Warning, which I had never seen. First time I've been wanting to see this because the cast: Martin Landau, mm-hmm. Cameron Mitchell,
buddy.
Neville Brand, Jack Palance, a young David Caruso.
Yeah.
Directed by an old Junesploitation category, Graydon Clark.
Yep.
I think I watched The Bad Bunch that year, but anyway, Landau plays an old paranoid, like retired army sergeant who he's like in a small country town. Everybody thinks he's insane because he yells and claims that he sees these aliens.
Yeah.
And he is literally out of his mind in this. He's referring to everybody as soldiers. It has these great special effects with like these hairy alien frisbees flying through the air and latching on to people. Draining them. It's shot by Dean Cundey,
yep.
which is fucking amazing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I say for anybody who's listening and planning to participate in Junesploitation, I think this would be a great aliens pick. Again, this one has lower ratings than I gave it. I gave it like 4 stars.
Oh, okay. That's
It was exactly made for me.
It's fun. It's I think it's a lot of fun, but 4 stars. Yeah,
Kevin Peter Hall plays the alien. He played the Predator in all the Predator movies. Right. He was Harry and the Henderson. I mean, it's too perfect to not watch before you leave this planet. Okay, so something else I learned about Landau while prepping for this episode was that he was an acting coach to a lot of actors, but one that really stood out to me was one of his acting students, Warren Oates.
No shit.
Yeah.
Aww.
He was actually teaching acting while he was a regular on The Outer Limits, Martin Landau. And he said it made him pretty much practice what he preached because he had these kids watching him and his performances. So he said he was always kept on his toes as an actor, which I think is really endearing to read about.
Yeah. Oh, Warren Oates.
Next up, we have Diane Baker. Okay, so she plays Vivia Mandor. Before filming started for The Ghost of Sierra de Cobra, she had just wrapped up probably, I wouldn't say it's like her, you know, biggest like starring role or anything, but it's a role that she's probably best remembered for is Sean Connery's sister-in-law, Lil, in Alfred Hitchcock's Marnie.
Mm-hmm.
So big role. And she pops up in a lot of cool movies. The Silence of the Lambs, The Net, Ben Stiller's The Cable Guy. She has a small role in Christopher Guest's A Mighty Wind. She played Joan Crawford's daughter in the Great William Castle thriller Straight Jacket.
Yeah.
Also from 1964. you watched one of her films called Police Story.
I did, yeah. I was excited about this one because it's got Vic Morrow and Chuck Connors in it. And it's basically Dirty Harry light. And it's not as cool as that sounds. It's also like about this squad who is kind of like, you guys go in and do all the dirty work, and Vic Morrow leads it, and Chuck Connors is a bad guy they're trying to take down. Chuck Connors is fucking great in this movie.
Yeah.
Because he's always great as a bad guy.
Yeah, he is.
But it should have been more focused on him, but obviously this was another pilot for the series Police Story or something like that.
Okay, it's a TV movie.
Another TV movie pilot. So I liked it. She plays a woman who, in the opening robbery, she's like one of the victims. Not a victim. She doesn't die. She's one of the hostages in the grocery store robbery. And then she and Vic Morrow start dating. And I wasn't interested in their relationship. Yeah, it's okay. I had high hopes for it, just based on like who's in it, but didn't quite deliver. There's some other movies I've watched in the past from her. I mentioned, this is another TV movie I mentioned in the Amanda episode, A Little Game with a Creepy Kid with like the glasses.
Oh, right. Ugh. Oh, yeah. He's on the poster.
Yeah. Yeah. She's in that one. And then there's another one I watched a few years ago called The Old Man Who Cried Wolf, starring Edward G. Robinson and Martin Balsam. That's really, really good. But yeah, she's great in it. And what's so interesting to me is I think the first time I remember her, like seeing her in older movies, I remember her as the senator in Silence of the Lambs. And her voice is exactly the same. Like there's some actors who over time, like they start sounding older.
Right.
Her voice always sounds exactly the same. Well,
to me, she always looks the same. And I mean, she looks older, but she has a very recognizable face.
Yeah. And her hair is always the same too.
It is.
I'm like, is that in her contract? Like she has to keep this hairstyle.
Yeah. One thing I want to point out is she pulled off the very fascinating to me feat of being in both ER and Chicago Hope. Which,
oh my God,
blows me away. She did a ton of television. She was in Murder, She Wrote, The Love Boat, Bonanza, House. She's great.
But I know how you feel about ER, so clearly she was better in Chicago Hope, I'm assuming. Yeah,
I saw that. That's the only episode I remember.
Okay.
She had a really good haircut. okay, and of course now we have Dame Judith Anderson.
Yes.
Playing Paulina, playing Mrs. Danvers from Rebecca.
Yeah.
That's who it is.
It's her doing her Mrs. Danvers impression. Yeah.
Yeah. So with Landau, Baker, Anderson, Stefano driving this thing, there's so much to link from this movie to Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think Stefano's wearing his influences on his sleeves for sure while filming this. Rebecca seems to be a big part of that.
Yeah.
Especially looking at that Paulina character. But she was a renowned Australian stage and film actress. She was a Broadway star for a while. She was in Otto Preminger's Laura. She played Big Mama in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. She was in The Ten Commandments. She was the Vulcan High Priestess who restores Spock's memory to his body.
Yes.
In the search for Spock.
Yeah.
Anthony Mann's The Furies. You mentioned just a minute ago Edward G. Robinson. I watched a movie that was directed by Delmer Daves, who's one of my favorites. 310 mm-hmm. to Yuma, Jubal's one of my favorites.
Yeah, yeah.
But The Red House from 1947.
Oh, okay.
And she plays Edward G. Robinson's sister. And her part is kind of small. She does get kind of, when she's on, she gets some screen time and a lot of dialogue. But she's help hiding this terrible family secret. Mm. It's pretty dark. I love it. I totally recommend it.
Okay.
But I think I'd imagine most of the films Judith Anderson is in is worth watching.
Yeah.
She's just fantastic to watch. The rest of the cast, they have kind of small roles. Tom Sincox plays Henry Mandor, you know, the blind guy. Mm-hmm. He's whatever in this.
He's fine. Whatever. Yeah. He's only in a few scenes and he's playing a blind guy. Not very well.
So Stefano originally cast and had signed John Drew Barrymore as Henry Mandor.
Oh,
but CBS voted it down. They got to get rid of him.
Fuck you, CBS.
And he shot scenes, so they had to do some reshoots because CBS are like, he is not delivering at all. So Tom Sincox was brought in. They had to reshoot scenes and do some voice dubbing. Yeah, she just didn't fit the role, apparently.
Okay.
But yeah, he was mainly a TV actor in a ton of series from the 60s to 80s, Green Hornet, Gunsmoke, Columbo, Knight Rider, all sorts of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And then the other actors in this are, again, Outer Limits regulars. Nellie Burt, who plays Mary Finch. She's Orion's housekeeper.
She's my favorite.
Yeah, she's kind of the words of wisdom girl in here, yeah. Or character. Leonard Stone plays Benedict Sloan, Orion's kind of architect partner, I guess.
Something like that.
Yeah, or he's an attorney. Manager, I don't know what he is.
Maybe.
Yeah, an agent. I couldn't really tell.
He's architects kind of, need an agent? I don't know what he is, but he...
I think he's like a business partner. And
yeah.
Because whenever he pops up, he's just talking about like restoring shit.
Right.
Maybe he works like for the city council. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I immediately recognized him when he popped up on screen.
Yeah.
One of my favorite movies, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. He plays Violet's dad.
Dad, yeah.
Violet, you're turning Violet. Violet? But yeah, these two characters, they would have undoubtedly been regulars on the show if it were picked up. And that's all I got.
It was heavy on the cast and crew this episode. We'll get more into this film right after this promo from our network.
This episode is presented by ayahuasca. Man, it keeps you on your toes.
You're listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal, providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.
Okay, so this is a really well-made TV movie.
Yeah.
1964. You kind of have to commend like what it's going for as far as creep factor. I think we already said the reasons that it's so well-made is because of Conrad Hall. Mm-hmm. But I think it's kind of, I don't know, it's super stylish for a show. Even like, and if you look at shows now, like not for like a public television show, broadcast yeah. show.
I think it's the... combination of the gothic elements with modern elements, which are really interesting to me because you've got, you know, ghosts and the great looking fucking ghost, by the way, like there's a few ghosts, but the blood spattered ghost, the ghost of Sierra del Cobre. So you've got ghosts, crypts, you've got that mission. And then the modern, you've got obviously his Orion's house on the beach and this modern element to it. That being said, I think that Orion's role, because you know how like, you know, we talked about movie, like these pilots where there's a connection between their day job, like in Fear No Evil,
yeah.
You know, Louis Jordan, he's a psychologist, but he also, it kind of bleeds into like his side hustle of this paranormal sort of investigation.
Right.
These two seem completely separate. Like, oh, I'm an architect. And then all the way over here, I'm just fascinated. And his explanation is like, well, I've worked on a lot of old buildings and seen things that I can't explain. And so it seems more like a hobby than anything versus like an actual expert. So if it were more like he has to go around the country for all these different like restorations, but
right.
like these people keep, that can get old though. Now I'm talking myself out of it. Cause I was thinking like, oh, well this hotel is haunted or like this place that they want to restore. Like there's all these things, but then that could get old cause it's the same thing over. So never mind. I talked myself out of it. Back it up. Never mind.
Yeah. But no, I see where you're going with it. I mean, it is like an odd, cause you know, Dr. Sorrell and Fear No Evil, he kind of had, I guess he has like, you know, he has these fascinations with paranormal too.
Yeah.
But I do think it is tied to the restorations and like all these haunted houses that he keeps talking about. There's a lot of elements that make this work really well and just, you know, make it worth watching. Like I said, like there's a lot of handheld shots from Conrad Howell and Bill Fraker, like throughout, like following Vivia and Orion through the crypt in the beginning,
yeah,
which is really cool. Every article I read, a review of the movie I read, brings up the shot of the vial transitioning into Judith Anderson's mm-hmm. Silhouette on the beach, which
yeah.
is amazing, like to do for television work.
Yeah.
that ghost. A lot of this stuff I read, most people think the ghost looks silly.
Fuck you, people.
I think, like, as soon as I saw that, I was like, this is really fucking effective.
Yeah.
It's like this negative reversal effect. Apparently it was used in a 1963 Outer Limits episode called The Galaxy Bean. So okay. Stefano pulled that. I'm sure Conrad Hall shot that episode. So they knew what they were doing. But it's really, really fucking good. If you, because it is a negative reversal, if you can actually get the image and flip the color, mm-hmm. reverse it, you'll see how like the actress was painted up with like it's white under eyes. Right. And I think there's like they spray something to make it look like she's, you know, wet.
Yeah.
But yeah, I loved the ghost. Yes. Yeah. Did you watch both versions?
I did. Yeah. I watched the full version last night and then I watched the TV or the less than an hour TV version this morning before recording.
Yeah, there's a lot of differences. Do you have a preference?
I prefer the TV version,
yeah.
The shorter one. And honestly, the reviews, after I watched it, I was like, okay, I prefer that one. And then I was like, let's see what the reviews say. And I went through a bunch of Letterboxd reviews. And it seems nearly split down the middle on what people prefer. Like some people think that the extended version of it adds more atmosphere. And I'm like, okay, well, I you know, Martin Landau spending 10 minutes lighting a candle or like a telephone pole shot holding for, I was like, I wanted to look at my watch. I was like,
I liked it. That reminded me of Firewalk with me, just with the electric power lines. I'm like, Firewalk.
Okay, fine. But I'll give you that.
No, but I know exactly what you're saying.
But like you feel the padding in it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I don't necessarily think that you need all of that for the atmosphere. I think it's already there in the TV episode. And because it has all these elements in it, like when he's home and he's got his candelabra and the door blows open and he walks slowly there and you start to see Paulina like come into frame and, you know, just all of these moments, I think still do that. I definitely prefer the TV version. I think this would have made a really great series.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the only thing I like about the 80 minute feature version is there are great lines of dialogue that's spoken that's not in the TV pilot.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of great lines. Like a wounded deer leaps highest. I think it was, who said that? I think it was Paulina. The way that people talk and act in this, like it seems like they're stuck in a poem. Like it's very like lyrical. Stefano knows how to write a screenplay.
Yeah, there's one when he, and this isn't in the TV one, there's like an added scene of him picking up some woman on the beach.
Yeah, so random.
And I think this is when the line is, but he says the doors were hanging open like eyelids. No one bothered to put pennies on.
Yes.
And I was like, hell yeah, that's straight out of a poem.
Yeah. I had learned from that scene that was inserted into the, you know, for padding, which is, it's completely pointless. This girl never pops up. It's believed she was supposed to play Sloane's secretary.
Okay.
So they had this actress and they decided to shoot this scene and maybe introduce her later on in other episodes, but
makes sense.
Yeah. That there's some great lines in, you know, that interaction where she's like, did you break into the cellar window? And then he says that line you just said. At the end though, with the big reveal, that's when a lot of them are brought up, like Paulina saying ghost, I've never seen a ghost, but I have seen the police. I love that. Vivia says, I thought fear was better than death. It isn't, it's only slower. But no, I hate that scene of him picking up that blonde bombshell.
Yeah.
But I mean, what a fucking pickup line. Like, hey, would you like to spend the night in a haunted house? Like,
I mean, yeah, respect.
Yeah. Some of the differences though, too, like you said, there's a lot of padding. Especially the introduction for the film. They recycle a bunch of shots throughout the movie, which just goes on way too long. The ending, though, is I did first watch the feature film. I liked it. I loved all the kind of twists and turns. I thought the ending would never end, though. It would just go on and on.
Yeah, I was like, oh, and I was like, oh, now we're not done yet. Okay.
Yeah, it's so, I mean, I'm just going to jump in.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, So the ending is, you know, Vivia is being haunted by the ghost the whole time of a murdered teacher in the mission of Sierra de Cobra. So a teacher was murdered. tourists would come into this Mission to Cobra, and they would take him down to the tombs, and the mom would kind of slip some ayahuasca in their drinks to make him think that there was some sort of spirit. This one particular teacher wasn't believing it, so they gave her a little more. She ended up becoming like raging mad, so they locked her in a tomb and she died there. And they kind of kept a secret, so the ghosts of the teachers come back half dead, half alive, or something, they keep saying. And haunts Vivia and ends up forcing Paulina to kill herself. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how the TV pilot ends, is she kills herself. Vivia and Orion are kind of like, okay, you were just a kid, let's go. And they just walk out.
Yeah.
But the film version is then she asks Vivia, you know, the mother, Paulina's killed. Vivia is walking out with Orion, says like, can you carry my dead mom to the car? He's like, yeah, sure. Okay. And she gets in the car. Then she's haunted by her mother's ghost, right? Who's trying to get her like this vial again of the drug. And she drives off of the cliff and kills herself.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, that's cool. That'd be a cool ending.
But and then it keeps going.
Then it goes up to the cliff. And then there's Orion talking to Mrs. Finch. And he starts explaining she saw the ghost of her mother. And like, how do you know? Like, okay.
Yeah.
And then it's not over.
Nope.
Because Sloan drives up.
Yep.
And this, to me, this ending felt more TV pilot than the TV pilot, because it ends like on a humorous note where he's like, oh, we have a business meeting and, you know, so-and-so. And, you know, Finch is like, well, let me put some coffee on.
Yeah.
It just kept fucking going. I was like, end already, please.
Yeah. It's tedious in the end. And I agree. I prefer the TV movie or the TV version ending. And as much as I do like more Mrs. Finch, because I mentioned, you know, she's my favorite. She refuses to believe in ghosts.
Right.
Solidarity. I think I like this aspect of you have her and Paulina, the Vivia's mom, like these sort of dueling maids. You've got almost these like this sort of twin effect, one good, one evil. You know, one is like the more sort of cynical one and like the realistic one, and the other one is like evil and plotting and has all these secrets. I mean, like, yeah, like Judith Anderson is out there doing her best Mrs. Danvers impression, but I always gravitate towards Snark, and that's definitely Mrs. Finch.
Yeah, that is a benefit of the extended, the padded time, because there are more scenes with Mrs. Finch. I think, you know, it adds to the skepticism of what's happening. And there are extra scenes, too, of Judith Anderson. Like, there's that long-ass 6-minute walk between Orion and Vivia where she's talking about the estate,
right,
the land. He's talking about haunted houses and what he believes spirits to be. And it's way more spoiled. Like, it really, it takes away from the mystery of the whole story, because you see Judith Anderson as Paulina watching them and like running across the road. Like,
right.
To me, at that point, it's predictable. I mean, I think it's kind of predictable. You've as soon as she pops up in the first 2 minutes, you're like, she did it.
Yeah.
You know, she's the ghost. But there are twists and turns that, you know, to get you to that finale of what she actually did. And I love that it kept the supernatural element. It's not her doing like projections or anything, trying to get rich or something.
Yeah. It's not the end of Mania with like a little board where you're like, oh, that's a little, you're controlling all these supernatural things happening there.
Lisa.
I do like that we're debunking Henry's mom haunting someone, even though the setup for that, you know, having a phone in the crypt,
right,
is like a perfect setup for something like that. But I do like that we've debunked like, okay, there's a corpse there. It's not a ghost. Like we don't have this ghost, but we do have the ghost of Sierra de Cobre. We do have the ghost of this American teacher who was killed. And we have the Paulina's ghost at the very end.
Right.
So it's like, we've got, you know, 1 out of 4 hauntings are actually not real. And I'm like, about 0 out of 4 are real.
Yeah. And stepping back too, when you look at the title, it's kind of the spoiler. Like it's exactly how it ends. It's the ghost of Sierra de Cobre.
Yeah.
And a few other favorite moments from, you know, from this film is, you know, I love the opening shot of the waves covering the city of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
It's like this kind of optical dissolve. It's kind of like waves destroying a sandcastle, mm-hmm. which is really fun to watch.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite scenes is at the end when Judith Anderson is in the car and she's screaming for help because her car is slowly being pushed by the spirit, by the ghost, off the cliff. And Martin Landau runs out and he's like holding onto the door, like just with his weight, trying to stop the car, and it stops. I love that scene because I'm like, that's exactly what I would do. And it just seems so real, but fake.
Yeah. I had a Rick Dalton moment in this.
Oh, yeah?
When they're in the crypt and Martin Landau picks up the cross and on it, it says dial H-E-L-P. And I was like, dial help.
Yeah. Yeah, that whole thing was funny too, where he's like, nobody knows the code. He's like, it's on a fucking cross in the crypt. It's like, well, it's a direct line. I don't know. Paulina created a second one. You know, there's a lot of fun moments. So
yeah,
overall, I would recommend this.
Yeah, I still recommend it. If I had to choose which one to recommend, I would recommend the TV version, the 54-ish minute one. But if you're curious, you know, watch both versions to see the difference.
Right. Yeah. Like you said, a lot of people are split down the middle, which they prefer.
Yeah.
I also prefer the pilot version more. I think the padding's unnecessary. Yeah. It becomes a little silly, and I think it takes away from the mystery. But Stefano also said he preferred the TV version well over the other, which was the original. Okay. What do you pair with this?
I think what came to mind when I first started watching this, and we both watched this either for Horror Gives Back or Gene-sploitation a few years ago, but Premature Burial from 1962.
Yes.
Definitely has those vibes. I think those would probably pair fairly well together. And got some same elements there. Even thought about going like the psychic route and with Fulci's psychic. Maybe that one. And then like the ghost crying sounds reminded me a lot of, I watched a lot of fucking La Llorona movies, folks, for the book.
Yeah, definitely La Llorona, for sure.
And so I'd have to think about it. Probably like Curse of the Crying Woman, where you hear like those moaning cries, like, ah, mis hijos, kind of thing. I think any one of those would work. But I ultimately landed on something, and this is going to be a first, I think, for Unsung Horrors.
Hmm.
I picked a TV episode for a double feature.
Oh yeah. It works perfect with this.
Because I think it works because, you know, this was a TV pilot and it is a shorter episode. It's only about 30 minutes because it's an episode of The Twilight Zone, from season 5, episode 19, Night Call, 1964. For folks interested, this is on Daily Motion or Paramount Plus. It's directed by Jacques Tourneur.
Oh, wow.
And it is based on a Richard Matheson short story called Sorry, Right Number, which was later retitled to Long Distance Call when it was anthologized. There's also a Twilight Zone episode with that title, Long Distance Call, and that's about a boy who uses a toy phone to communicate with his dead grandmother. So, and that's the reason why this episode that I picked is Night Call doesn't have that same title, because they were like, oh, we already have an episode called that.
Right.
So we're going to call this. Anyway, so Night Call, 1964, the Twilight Zone episode, is about an elderly woman, Elva, who keeps receiving anonymous staticky calls where the man on the other end keeps saying like, hello, and like, where are you? I need to see you. I need to talk to you. It's short. It's 25 minutes. So I don't want to spoil the ending, but it's pretty great. And nice. If you've read the Richard Matheson story, you know how it ends. But I would go, yeah, I'm going to go TV episode.
That's very interesting, Erica.
Oh.
No, I didn't. But I really, my first pick was after I had watched Steven Spielberg's Savage with Martin Landau. I thought it'd be a great Martin Landau can't catch a break, failed TV pilot, double feature. But, you know, I wanted to, you know, stick more to the horror element of the story. I thought Conrad Hall and his awesome cinematography, a lot of his stuff would pair well, specifically Incubus with the black and white photography.
Yeah.
But I latched on to the fear of being buried alive. So you mentioned mine.
Oh.
I'm going with the premature burial.
Sick.
Because it is... I love that. I watched that, I think, for a Horror Gives Back years and years ago.
I think you and I watched it the same year. Like, I think that
was that's right.
What
that's
we started off when we were like, same scene.
It was Corman, yeah. But yeah, I mean, apparently this fear of being buried alive was a deeply rooted fear in Western culture in the 19th century, which, you know, Edgar Allan Poe was alive, so he wrote that story. Apparently hundreds of cases were reported where doctors mistakenly pronounced someone dead. And since Stefano incorporated this fear into the Ghost of Sierra de Cobre, I'm I'm going with The Premature Burial from 1962. And it basically focuses on a man who's consumed with the fear of being buried alive. So he pimps out his burial vault in preparation for his falsely claimed death and burial.
Love it.
Yeah. When I was watching that too, I remember thinking like, I want to pimp out my tough shed. I just got a tough shed. It's like, I'm going to do what he's doing, you know, but I haven't yet. Yeah, that one's on Tubi right now. And it's so good. Okay. What's your next pick?
All right. Next pick. We already mentioned it at the beginning of the episode. Junesploitation is coming up. Mm-hmm. One of our favorite movie events of the year. Again, plugging our Discord. It's also a great reason to join our Discord as we have folks sharing their lists. We've got a channel dedicated to that. Great way to discover new movies, not just from our annual Junesploitation wrap-up episode, which we will do. So one of the categories for Junesploitation this year is ripoffs. Mm-hmm. And coincidentally, or maybe I had this plan for later this year, but pushed it up because of this category, my next pick is a knockoff or remake or ripoff, whatever you want to call it. And we love them here, right?
Absolutely.
Jaws knockoffs, Exorcist rock knockoffs. We did Demon Witch Child, Rosemary's Baby, The Omen. All knockoffs are fun, especially when they're done by the Italians. So I've got one, though, that is kind of similar to Patrick Still Lives, mainly because it's a knockoff of a great non-mainstream horror movie. Because when we think knockoffs, usually we're doing them of familiar films. Jaws, right. Rosemary's Baby, The Omen, etc.
Exorcist, right.
Yeah. So it's a great non-mainstream horror movie. One that not everyone has seen, but most horror fans do know of it. And this is a ripoff of The Living Dead at Manchester Morgue.
Okay. Yeah.
AKA Let Sleeping Corpses Lie, which is a Spanish-Italian co-production directed by Jorge Grau. And this ripoff is not Italian. It is not Spanish. It is not American or even Filipino or Philippine or Chinese. It's South Korean.
Oh, yeah. Shit.
So we are going to be covering A Monstrous Corpse from 1981. It's about a small mountain village. They have a new radio transmitter installed, and that's causing the dead to reanimate. Now, I want to set proper expectations going into this. This is not treading any new water. And if you've seen Manchester Morgue, you pretty much know what to expect from this. Albeit this is a bit more tame than its source material. They had some more censorship laws going on there. But it's a unique situation to have a remake that's not only about a less popular zombie movie, but it's also South Korean. So I think it's a good chance for us to shine a spotlight over there for a bit.
Heck yeah, it's the first pick from South Korea.
Yeah. So as of this recording, it has 138 views on Letterboxd, and it is available on YouTube with subtitles. So A Monstrous Corpse for next episode.
Yeah.
All right. If you are not already, you can follow this podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can join our Discord at the link in our link tree. You can follow me on Letterboxd, Instagram, and Twitter at Hex Massacre.
And you could follow me on Letterboxd and Instagram at L Scheibe.
All right. Thanks everyone for listening. Hope you all join us for Junesploitation, and we'll see you back next episode for Monstrous Corpse.
Bye.
Bye.
Hear it, hear it, hear my heartbeat pounding, pounding like a drum, louder, louder goes my heartbeat as nearer and nearer you come. So hurry, hurry, says my heartbeat, take me, touch me, make me thrill. Faster, faster goes my heartbeat, I try but I can't keep it still. They say when a heart beats too wildly that it breaks like a toy balloon. But darling, that's putting it mildly compared to what will happen to me if something doesn't happen soon. Listen, listen to my heartbeat crying, sighing breathlessly. Tell it, tell it, tell my heartbeat that your heart beats for me. Listen, listen to my heartbeat crying, sighing breathlessly. Tell it, tell it, tell my heartbeat that your heart beats for me.
Hey, it's Death by Video.
I'm Phil.
I'm Kit.
And I'm Graham, saying welcome to our podcast full of merry movie mayhem.
Ever wonder what an Irish kung fu movie would look like?
It's called Fatal Deviation, and we covered it.
Ever wonder what a movie about 1,000 cats would look like?
It's called Night of 1,000 Cats, and we covered it.
And it stars Hugo Stiglitz. Listen to Death by Video to hear us discuss and dissect some of the weirdest, wildest, and wackiest films ever made. All this and more on Death by Video!
Woo!